Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Amber Balakian on the show. Amber is the owner of Balakian Farms, a fourth-generation organic farm rooted in Reedley, California. Growing up surrounded by agriculture, Amber developed a deep respect for sustainable farming and a passion for bringing high-quality organic produce to her community. At Balakian Farms, Amber focuses on preserving her family's farming legacy while innovating to meet today's demands, from tree fruit to their unique line of organic blended heirloom tomatoes. Amber is also a college professor, supporting students in developing entrepreneurial skills and a passion for business. Amber's ultimate goal is to honor her farm's heritage while paving the way for a sustainable and inclusive growth in the farming industry. Amber and I talk about an array of topics, mostly focused around agriculture, but also about business and learning. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and Baker will take us there. Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! So, Amber, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I like to eat at Richard's Prime Rib and Seafood if I'm having dinner. And I love like the traditional steakhouses. And then I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but Oiza. It's like a Japanese place where, or Japanese restaurant at River Park. And they have like amazing sushi, and I love seafood. And if I'm getting tacos, I love El Rico's. In fact, I just went there this past weekend.
Okay, so. What's your steakhouse order? I'll confess, I don't go to steakhouses as much as I used to.
Okay.
But I do love a good steak. So talk to me about your order at Richard's, typically.
I typically get the prime rib. Like, you have to get the prime rib, because that's what they're known for, I feel like. And I love steak. I'm like red meat kind of person. So I usually get the smaller, because their prime ribs are really, can be massive. So I usually get like the smaller one. And then it comes with all like the sides, the green beans and baked potato. I'm very like traditional when it comes to steak.
Gotcha. So.
Well, and raw horseradish.
I was just about to ask that, because there's so much discussion these days about gut microbiomes and all that kind of stuff. And everyone's trying to eat as much pickled or food that has these helpful agents. But horseradish still is in its own category.
Yeah, I just like the taste. I just like the spiciness. It reminds me of it, like wasabi. So I don't know like the health benefits, but it tastes amazing with the prime rib. So I go with the raw.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, let's jump into a number of questions. We're going to talk about agriculture a lot. We're going to talk about marketing. We're going to talk about a lot of things, but I want to start with you and your family. Mm-hmm. And your site has a beautiful page that talks about the history of your family and farm. Can you briefly tell the story of how the Balakians, and I'm saying that right, Balakian, correct?
Yes, Balakian, you said it correctly.
And the Krikorians arrived in the Central Valley. And what was the connection to the Armenian genocide? And before I jump in, is Ben Krikorian, is that someone in that family? I know that my wife's Mennonite, and so I know that like her last name is Pinner. And so sometimes I'll meet a Pinner, I'll be like, oh, are you connected to that Pinner? And then, no, there's a host of Pinners. So is Ben in that part of the family, or is that?
So the Krikorian side was actually, they're from Boston. So they moved. So it's mainly, I would say, the Balakians that are, and I don't want to say originally from this area, but a lot of them are moved to this area. But the Krikorian side, that's on my grandmother's side. And yeah, they were living in Boston and then moved to Fresno.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you could briefly tell the story of arrival in the Central Valley, mm-hmm. the connection to the Armenian genocide.
Sure. My great-grandfather, he's the one that immigrated from Armenia, and that was during the genocide. So that was their way of escaping what was going on in Armenia at the time. And so they moved to the United States and they moved to the Central Valley. And if you've ever been to Armenia, which I'm assuming you have not, but for anyone that has been, it's very similar. Like when I went, it looked very similar to Fresno, like the landscape and everything. It was pretty shocking. I felt like I was like driving through the foothills of Fresno. So they moved here and they started farming. They originally started farming grapes in Reedley, actually like 5 minutes from where our farm is today. And the whole family, my grandfather's brothers and sisters, they all worked on a farm. They were very poor. And that's how they made their living, was just farming. And then they'd go into town and sell the produce. And a lot of them went on and went to college and did other things, but my grandfather continued farming and he actually bought the ranch that we farm today. And then he met my grandmother, Stella, and that's a Krikorian side. And like I said, her family was from Boston. They moved over here because they were visiting, and her sister, Edna, convinced their parents to stay because it didn't snow here. It's not like Boston, and they didn't really want to go back to that, so they ended up moving and staying. And then yeah, and my grandparents got married and they built a house on our property, and it's about 20 acres, and so that's like our main farm that we continue to operate today.
Okay.
Yeah.
For some people that grow up with a family business, deciding whether you're going to continue a legacy of being involved with a family business can be a complicated decision. I think some people choose it for the security of it because they know that it works and they've seen it work and they can continue at work. Some people do it because it's all they know. Some people do it for, I did a podcast a while ago with a documentarian that looked at a very famous winery in San Jose, where the children of the winemaker were struggling to discern whether they wanted to continue the family business. And the whole documentary was about kind of them wrestling with how to carry on legacy, but also making it your own. So, can you talk a little bit about your rubric or how you came to a conclusion that you wanted to continue working in the business that your family has worked in for generations?
Yeah, just touching on what you just said, it wasn't a linear process for me. It was, and I should also mention, like, my mom, she's the one that really continued the farm, and she's transitioned to organic, and she really helped to grow it to what it is today. But for me, I did not want to go into farming. I wanted to get as far away from Fresno, Central Valley, no disrespect, but I was 17 going into college and I wanted to do something else. And I went to undergrad in San Diego and then I moved to the Boston, like Cambridge, to pursue my graduate degree. And I did want to go into the corporate type of career because that's what the majority of my classmates were doing and just what I thought made the most sense for me at the time. But while I was out there, it changed my perspective on what I had here back at home. And a lot of it was, you don't know what you have till you don't have it. And so even then though, I wasn't 100% like set on this is, I want to go back and farm. I didn't know what I was going to really do. I just thought, let me go back before I get into the corporate world. Let me go back and help my family with managing and kind of use what I've learned in college to see if I can help them in some way. And I don't know how much that I helped, but I came back, and that's when I started like making the value-added products. I started just looking into different things, and that evolved into me continuing making those products, but then also getting a job teaching. I started teaching at Reedley College, which was like perfect schedule for farming because I was off in the summers, which was like our peak season. So, but that whole process, I want to say, was like a 10-year process to where I'm at today, which is now I, help manage it in a much broader capacity. So I don't want to say it was like a decision that I made. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. It was like a gradual process that just happened over time, I'd say.
So no pun
I don't know if
intended, but it
that.
was organic.
Yeah.
Let's jump into some more agricultural specific questions. I've asked this to a number of farmers, but I'm curious about your perspective. So if we kind of look at it from 20,000 feet, what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing is that there's a bifurcation in terms of farming size. You have consolidation going on in the industry quite a bit, but then you also have the emergence of these boutique farms that use storytelling as a way to compensate for the lack of scale. Are you seeing this as well? Are you seeing the pushing out of the middle? Is that your perspective, or do you have a different perspective?
No, I think that it is, and you said it like very well and clear that that is really what is happening in the industry. And I would say, like, more so now, and that even in itself has been somewhat gradual over time, but it's definitely becoming where you're either this massive farm or it's like, you're owned by these like private equity companies, and they're just like consolidating large scale agriculture in that way to where it's like somebody like us, we can't even really compete with that. So in order to sustain ourselves, we've had to get creative and, like you said, use our storytelling to like directly connect to the customers, because I think different types of customers, and even for the same customer, I would say that the same customer can have different preferences depending on even like the time of year or whatever the climate is at the time. But I think for us, like the customers that we're trying to connect with, they value those things in a sense. They're not the ones that are just going to the store and trying to pick up produce and not really. They don't care where it came from. They're not looking at those things. And so there is a market for the customer that is valuing, like you said, the story and the history and the people behind the product. And I think the farms that are using that to really market themselves are appealing to that specific type of customer. And so they've been able to find like this niche, so that they can, I don't even want to say compete with the huge, gigantic, those consolidated farms, but they're able to still be sustainable in the midst of that, I would say. But there isn't, yeah, there, I feel like it's like you're one or the other. Like you said, I don't see a lot of like the mid-sized farms that I would say that there were in the past. So, yeah.
Yeah, so let's lean into that a little bit more. We know that the demand for food is highly elastic, meaning that consumers respond to price changes. So when I'm at Whole Foods, for example, if I'm wandering down the aisle and I see a big bag of organic green beans and I see a big bag a bundle of organic asparagus and I see that one is on sale, I might choose to buy it as opposed to the other one, even if it means modify the thing that I'm going to cook that night. And so my question is, as it relates to storytelling and boutique farms leaning into this, do you think that the storytelling has a limit in terms of price sensitivity for consumers? I had a friend who went to, she wandered into an Erewhon, which is always dangerous for your credit card score, but she wandered into one looking for products from Big Little Farm, which is this kind of famous farm. There's a documentary about it. And she found some eggs, and I think the eggs were like $22 for a carton of 12. And even her, as someone that really valued that story, loved the documentary, watched the sequel, really believed in the mission of the farm, she couldn't get herself to a place where she could spend $22 on a
Justify
carton.
it.
Yeah. So how do you think about that? How do you think about price sensitivity and then storytelling and how they intersect?
Yeah, I will say Erewhon is one of our biggest customers. Yeah, they've been like a really supportive, amazing customer. I think in terms of like price sensitivity, especially now because of obviously like inflation and just all the different factors. Yes, I do. I would say there is a limit, but I think, and again, it just depends because the thing too is that there's so many factors in terms of price sensitivity. I do think that there is a limit. I think that there's always going to be customers for the most part, even those $22 eggs, there's somebody that's going to buy them. But the question is like, how many is that going to be
Yeah, what's the
enough?
volume on that? Is
Right.
that gonna make sense?
And is it enough to sustain? And just touching on that, yes, that seems like very high. And I don't know, but there's so many factors that I think, especially with farming, and I want to say, especially with farming in California, there's just so much cost associated with growing, even if you're organic, and that people don't, I think, realize. And maybe if you're comparing it to even like some of the organic good produce that's being like shipped from other countries, it's you can't, if you're growing produce out of California, you can't compete with that price wise. Yes, I think that there's just a lot of different factors when it comes to that, but I at some point I think yes, price does matter, even for that customer that is willing to pay more.
Okay. So obviously, you guys are farming organically, but I'm curious about your perspective vis-a-vis like other farms, either adjacent to you or the farming culture. Are we seeing any changes around pesticides and herbicides, at least within the kind of like the ether, if you will? Or do you think that kind of the movement, the broader movement away, is going to require some innovation and some generational shifts? What are your thoughts and perspectives on conversations around those topics right now?
So, in terms of pesticide, are you talking about organic or like
I'm talking about
conventional?
like the community of farmers. Like
Okay.
where kind of where is the state of discourse around those things? Is it pretty segregated in terms of organic farmers thinking one way,
Oh,
traditional farmers
yeah.
thinking another?
Yeah, I think it's pretty, yes, I think that people like just overall, especially with farmers, and they're going to follow suit in terms of what the customer wants. People's shift towards more like natural and using things that are better for you. Obviously, that's going to have an impact. At the same time, I think that it goes back to what the cost is, because for us, a lot of the farmers around us are much larger than we are, and I don't know exactly what they're using, but I think it's pretty much like it's been similar over the years because they have the way that they pack and what they have to account for is a lot different than the way that we do things organically, and then we pack everything by hand. They have to pack using different equipment, machinery, and a lot of the pesticides and things that they use to accommodate for that, it has to be like up to a certain standard, I would say. Because we're organic, we obviously have to follow the organic USDA guidelines for what we can and can't use. But that's not going to work for somebody that's doing it larger scale and having to. They're not going to go in and weed by hand, do things like that. They just can't. They can't because it doesn't, it's not cost effective for them. I don't know what, if there has been a shift. I don't know what kind of innovations they've come up with for pesticides and whatnot, but I don't see it like merging in a way where they're doing things like in a more like organic, like the way that we are necessarily, because it, yeah, doesn't make sense.
There's a lot of discussions these days that, and I don't think this is a zero sum kind of game between these two poles, but there's a lot of discussion about thinking about this kind of spectrum between sustainability and profitability. And I know they're not opposed ways, but oftentimes they are. How do you think about that? How do you conceptualize that? And like, how do you think about making choices when profitability and sustainability are opposed?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's like a hard, it's a hard thing to have to like with, because on the one hand, for us, the benefit of us being organic and being sustainable, and I don't want to say caring more for the land, but in a way, when you're not using all these harsh chemicals and pesticides and things like that, it is better for the land, but that comes at a higher cost. But then that's offset by our higher price that we charge. And then because we do that, our quality, to me, and based on what our customers say too, is a lot better. And I think a lot of that ties into the fact that we do use sustainable practices. I'm not sure that's always the case for everyone, but for us, it has been. And so that kind of offsets that. Now, if that were to change, and I want to say, like I said, the costs are a lot more than what they were. So for us, like our margins are smaller, even though the price is high. That's the thing that people don't see, is that the costs are so much greater than, say, what they were in the past. So if that were to ever shift, I mean, we would love to keep doing things as, and I don't know what would happen in that sense, but yeah, I mean, you have to be able to make a profit. Otherwise, like, it doesn't make sense for you to continue to do it as much as you would love to. You know, for us, this is, you know, the way that we, this is our business, this is our livelihood. And so if for whatever reason we were not able to continue doing that and make a profit, then it just wouldn't, I don't think it would make sense for us or for anybody for that. And I think that's what's happening.
You got to feed
with
yourself,
a lot of,
right? Feed
right.
Everybody else.
Exactly. Okay. And pay our employees and all of those things. I think that's why a lot of people are not, they're choosing to not continue to farm because of all of these factors.
Okay. We're recording this the day after a national election. We're not going to dig into any specific politics, but I am curious your perspective. It's not fun anyway. So beyond just like it being radioactive, it's just not that pleasurable.
Yeah.
But I'm curious generally, though, do you think agriculture would be benefited by depoliticizing itself a little bit? Whichever perspective you take, do you think there's like a major value add for politicizing agriculture? Some people might argue you could get your subsidies, whatever. But I also see that the damage that over-politicization of industries, what can happen when that becomes a thing, because then they become footballs that can get thrown around versus being neutral industries, where it's just more about what makes this industry sustainable versus who is going to be the patron of my industry. So how do you think about, do you think it would be better if agriculture was depoliticized in that way?
I do and I don't, because I do think that I totally am a proponent of free markets, but at the same time, I do see the value in having some control and some, the grants that are available and different programs that they have, and just having someone there to oversee the industry in a way to make sure, because again, too, you're dealing with food. I do think that there needs to be something there. But at the same time, and I've said this other times, other places, but I do feel like because it is very politicized and very much just tied to the government, it pushes out people, because everything gets very bureaucratic when the government gets involved, which is not always a good thing. I understand it, but it's not, it makes things sometimes overly complicated. And for somebody that cannot hire somebody to weed through all of the paperwork, the whatever it is, it puts you at a disadvantage. And farmers don't have time anyways because they have all these other things that they're having to deal with. Usually they're the ones that are doing it. Again, unless you're a very large entity, which then we're going back to what we talked about earlier. Then it's like, how do you compete? How do you sustain yourself? So I do think it I understand like the purpose and that they're trying to serve those people, but I think there's definitely a disconnect, and especially when it comes to getting like any types of funds and different things like that that the government has to offer, it goes to the people that have the resources and capabilities. It doesn't usually go to the people that actually need it.
Which makes sense. You know, you can hire a team of, a very large nonprofit can hire a team of grant writers that will always compete with a small nonprofit. And so that makes sense. Let's talk about gender for a second. At least as of 2023, women only made up about 36% of farming producers.
Oh,
In your
that's a
mind,
lot.
it is a lot. In your mind, if that got close to 50%, let's just say hypothetically, how do you think that would change agriculture in both its culture, like the culture of agriculture, and in products? Do you think it would mostly be the same, or do you think it would change in certain ways if there were more women in the industry?
I think it would change just because obviously women bring a different perspective, and because this is not only is ag mainly predominantly male, but it's also, I think, a very traditional industry. It's one of those industries that just, if you compare it to others, it just hasn't really caught up. It hasn't changed drastically over the years, surprisingly. So I think, and whether it's women or different cultures, I don't necessarily think it matters. I think anytime you bring in an outside perspective, it's going to bring innovation into, and that comes with, like you said, like the other products, maybe other processes. I think just a lot of positive change, even with like marketing. Ag is like notorious for just not being the best when it comes to marketing. And so I think that would definitely benefit the industry as a whole, just to have a different perspective on the way things should move forward in the future.
Okay. Well, let's jump into some specifics about produce because I have a number of questions. I enjoy gardening in my backyard. I'm not gardening at scale or anything. Start by this fickle, I guess it's a fruit that I've had challenges with, which is Armenian cucumbers. When should I harvest them? I've waited too long sometimes, I think, and they become rock hard and the seeds are the size of like quarters almost. What's the secret sauce in terms of what am I looking for in a ripe Armenian cucumber?
So for the, and this is the light one, right? Not the striped. Well,
Yeah.
I guess it doesn't matter, but
Yeah. I've gardened the particular, I've only grown them, I think, twice, but it was the light one each time.
So the light one, the way that we like to pick them is we harvest them when they're small. You can grow them all year. We typically will start in May, and then we'll do like several plantings, and that can go until August. But when we harvest them, you want them to be like the size of like a banana at the max size. Any bigger than that, and that's when it's your they just don't taste good when they're
That's
bigger.
what I
So,
learned. I tried to, I took the hard one and I brought it in and showed my wife, and she's like, "Oh, it's massive." And I was like, "All right, I'll just cut it up and we'll make it into
oh
a
no,
salad." And it was,
it's terrible.
I think we each took a bite and we're like, "That's sufficient." So harvesting them small, and you guys pickle them, correct?
Yes, and especially for the pickles, they have to be. We like it takes us time to sort through them because they have to be a certain size, just because, like I said, the flavor, it really does impact the flavor. They even get like bitter and they just, are not good when they're larger. So when I see those at sometimes at the stores or farmers market, the larger ones, I'm just like, oh my gosh, no, because they're
Those poor
not.
customers, they're just going to be turned
Yeah, they
off with
don't know
them
what they're gonna
forever.
get. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, my next question is about heirloom tomatoes. How would you
Okay.
describe the taste difference between like them versus something like beefsteak or Roma's? And do you think there's any dishes where heirloom tomatoes would be an inferior choice?
Oh, that's a good question. So the first part, the taste is you can't compare the taste. It's first of all, there's so many different heirlooms. At one point we had over 80 varieties, and they each just have a kind of a slightly different flavor, but for the most part, they're all very sweet. They're very like juicy. I don't know. Like I, it's very hard for me to
Yeah.
eat
Do you think they're,
a
are they more acidic than,
no.
okay, but
Some
sweet.
are.
Okay.
Some, yeah. So that's the thing. It's depending on what color you're gonna get. Like the darker colors always have more acidity. So like the purples, the pinks, the reds, and then the lighter the color, the usually I would say it's they're gonna be a little more sweeter because they have less acidity. But you just the even when you cut into it, like you could just see the difference because it's just like the water content is so much higher. It just, yeah, has such a better flavor. It's juicier. So I really rarely will eat just a regular. I don't eat tomatoes now in the when there's no heirlooms. I usually just eat tomatoes when they're in season because I just don't. I the flavor is just not, it's like eating cardboard to me or something.
Yeah.
It doesn't taste good.
Yes, it's the Garden of Eden story. Once you've tasted it, you can't.
Yeah.
Your eyes are open.
Yeah.
So
Not that extreme, but yeah.
in terms of your blended tomato product, what was the texture going for, and what were you in your mind imagining people using that for?
So it's actually a I don't want to say product, but something my grandma would make and use like all through me growing up. And so I didn't really have can we didn't use canned tomatoes when I was growing up. It was always like she would make that sauce in the winter, in the summer to have for winter, and so she'd have that all year round. But it's definitely, I would say it's like a cross between a sauce and like a crushed tomato. So it's a little more chunky, thicker, but it still has like all of the tomato. Like when they make tomato sauce, they usually take out the juice, a lot of the juices. And so she keeps that in there. And that really, when you're cooking with it and you reduce it, it really intensifies the flavor. So that. Essentially, you can use it for anything that you would use canned tomatoes for. I tell people use them for Bloody Marys. I never would have thought of that, but that's what some of them do. I have one customer from Florida. She'll buy 20 yellow jars and she loves the yellow blended tomatoes and she'll just use those for a drink. And but for me, I love to make pasta with it, I'll reduce it, just put a little olive oil, and then that makes just like the best pasta sauce like ever. So you can use it like for anything. It's just like a good staple to have on hand.
Okay. Do you think you can successfully scale novelty fruits like elephant heart plums, or is that always going to be like a small, like one-off, like niche thing for people that are looking for something a little different periodically?
Yeah, I'm surprised you know what elephant plums are because not a lot of people know. And that's one of my favorites. I don't want to say that you can't, but I don't think that would necessarily be like for us at least, like the customers that we do sell those to. Same thing with the donut peaches, you know, that. is more so of a novelty. And I feel like that's what makes it a novelty, is that it's just like a special, like very unique kind of more.
It's like almost like the
Yeah.
flea market, like the shoe market, like sneakers,
Yes.
where there's like certain limited edition sneakers that only certain people,
Right.
and then the price goes up, and then everyone wants them and covets them because they're limited.
Exactly. I feel like that's how, I don't want to say like all of our produce is like that, but we do have certain ones where it's okay, this is like Santa Rosa plums, or just where we have this short window and people are like super excited when we do get those in, and then they'll try to get as much as they can, and then that's it. That's it for the season. So I don't know. I feel like with certain things, I don't think everything needs to be scaled, if
Yeah.
that makes sense.
Couldn't agree more. All right. We're going to
Yeah.
jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a
Okay.
bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Feel free to pass on any of
Okay.
those. And you can also just a cop out if you don't want to take a side, is just say it's maybe properly rated. The market has
Okay.
arrived at the correct conclusion on the value of the product or idea.
Okay.
All right. We'll start with a simple one, which is me and Ed's Pizza.
I think it's underrated. Do I need to say why?
I would love for you to say why, and especially as
Okay.
someone that lived on the East Coast and had East Coast pizza, why do you think it's underrated?
I know. I think because, so I wasn't a big fan of Me and Ed's before, but I feel like the more I've learned, like I love that it's a family run, and then just even like how they do like the cornmeal crust and all of that. I don't know. I feel like I've grown to love it, and it's a good pizza for what we have locally. There's so many like big chains like Domino's and all of those. I feel like they've stayed strong since I was like young, when they're still thriving. So I would say underrated.
Okay, next one. The ideas and philosophy of agrarianism. And I can explain what I mean by that if you.
Okay, yes.
So agrarianism is just a philosophy that emerged in the early 20th century that, saw some intrinsic value and virtues in farming.
Yeah.
Valued rural life, connection to nature. They believed farming created virtues for farmers, like civic virtues and moral virtues of farming. There's been a lot of people that will push on this a little bit because it, in some ways, maybe limits what farming could look like in some ways because it can have different manifestations. I'm thinking of urban agriculture, for example, you're not in a rural place, but do you think those ideas are under or overrated?
There was a book about this, and I can't remember the name. If when I remember, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
But I hate to say, I would say that it's overrated,
Okay.
maybe,
Okay.
only because it's, yes, a lot of those theories and philosophies make sense, but that I think they don't take certain things into context.
Okay. All right. Next one. Next one's an either or. Baba ganoush or hummus?
Ooh, baba ganoush, because it's so much. Hummus is like very overrated.
Oh, yeah.
Baba ganoush is so good, and the
I think
garlic,
so
and
too. Yeah. I
yeah,
mean, I think
so
it
good.
sometimes it takes people a minute to get used to the texture of baba ganoush because it's a very different texture.
Yeah.
Flavor is so much more rich.
Oh yeah, and I love eggplant.
Same.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one. Fruit jerky. Under or overrated?
Ugh, overrated.
Okay. Explain.
I like dried fruit, but I feel like I see fruit jerky in like all the stores and get it, but I'm just can't. I'll just have a dried apricot or a dry. Yeah, I just feel like it's overrated.
Okay, next one, not an over versus underrated, but just a general question. Is there anything you can't put chamoy on?
I don't know.
Prime
You
rib,
can put
maybe?
it. Yeah. I don't use, I like tahine more than chamoy,
Okay.
but
What's the weirdest thing you
no.
put tahine on?
Okay. And my friend laughs at me because she brings a bottle with her wherever she goes, and then she knows that I'm going to take it. I just like to eat it plain, which is weird.
You just eat
It's
the
weird.
tahine powder plain?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I think I remember in
That's so
school.
bad for
Oh,
you, too.
no, it's whatever. We all have bad habits.
Yeah.
Next one, Whole Foods, over or underrated. You're just talking about
I've.
Erewhon and what a great relationship Whole Foods has gone through.
Yeah. And yeah, I think underrated, I would say. They're Whole Foods, they've been super supportive. I know people are just like, oh, it's again like Erewhon, it's just so expensive. But they really do, they're really good at supporting like small farms like ours. Like they don't have to do that. Like they can easily import their all their produce or just work with the larger growers, which they do that, but then they also like always have make space for farms like us. I would definitely say underrated.
Okay, next one, Goop.
Over.
Why?
No, I feel like it, and you're talking about Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, right?
Correct.
Okay. I just feel like it's like very disconnected from.
You think?
Yeah, and it's so expensive, and it just, yeah,
I
it's.
subscribe to their newsletters just so I
I'm
can
surprised
laugh at
you know what that is.
Yeah, I subscribe just so I can see what they're peddling. Because I do think that when you're looking for like market indications, sometimes you look
Yeah.
super high-end products to see what will eventually trickle down. And I hope that a lot of the things that they peddle don't trickle down. But
I know, even not to like bash anyone, but like even some of her things, I'm just like, this is. And I've even gotten her cookbook and stuff, but I get that it's trying, it's using all natural, and we're all about that, but I'm like, it's so far disconnected from what the reality is. I don't know. So, no,
absolutely.
definitely overrated.
Okay, two more. Urban agriculture. Now, I've heard some interesting takes on urban agriculture that are interesting to me. One of them is that it's just simply like signaling, like you're just saying, oh, I'm environmentally concerned, and so I do some farming in the city. But the actual like marginal utility of what you're doing is pretty low. It's just hard to farm, as you well know. And so
Yeah.
doing it in a city with all the complications of a city, like it probably feels great to the actual person that's doing it, like connection to nature, quote unquote. But I don't know like how like useful it will be for the food.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So do you think urban
Yeah.
agriculture is under or overrated? I just totally loaded the hell out of that question, I recognize.
I
But
know. I'm like.
I'm curious your point of view.
I would just say, honestly. Over. I know I'm probably gonna get hate from some people, but and it's not to say that, like you said, I think that there are people that are trying to do good in a sense, like bringing that to areas that are not, they're not exposed to agriculture. And I know that's not the case for everything, but I just, again, I always like look at, is that the best use of resources, is that like the best approach to take, or are there other
Let me
ways?
soapbox here for a second. I would almost prefer those people to support high quality farms doing
Yes.
quality work versus, ooh, look at my on my rooftop in Brooklyn. Look at my little
Exactly. Yes.
farm. And it's like it's super cool, but like, how long are you going to do this? Is this a hobby? You're not going to do it as long as family farms have been like yours, for example. So
No.
we both should stop talking. We're both going to get in trouble.
No, I well, on that point too, if we work really closely with Foodwise, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're in San Francisco, and that is their whole role, is they're supporting, they're not trying to farm, or which they definitely could. They have, you know, the resources and the funds to do that, but they're like, okay, we're gonna put all of that into supporting farmers all throughout California. And then they have the Ferry, they're the ones that run the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market. So to me, I'm like, that has a lot more impact than, yes, the rooftop farm. Like, to me, I'm like, what's the purpose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Last one, the word natural. It's bandied about and used in all sorts of packaging. You see it everywhere. Do you think we should just stop using
Overrated.
it? We should just stop using it in your mind?
Yeah, I think it's overrated because anybody can use that word, like literally any. I mean, we can make a product today and say that it's,
Natural Cheetos, natural Pepsi.
yeah, there was like that natural Coke or whatever, but they stopped selling it. Yeah, no, but what you really want to look for is like the organic or non-GMO, because it is so much more rigorous, the rigor that you have to go to get that certification. Like the bar is so much higher as opposed to let me just say natural because it sounds good, and it's become like a marketing thing. So yeah, it's overrated, I would say.
Yeah. All right. Let's close with a couple business questions. How do you think about developing new products? Do you begin with consumer interests or yours?
I would say usually mine, to be honest, which probably not always the best approach. But then, yeah, for me, developing products has been less about, okay, let me make as much money as I can, as opposed to like, it's just something that like I like to do and I like to create things, and it's like an outlet for me and I enjoy it. And, if it works, if it's successful, that's great. If it doesn't, then that's okay too. So
Yeah.
that's my approach.
Yeah, it's really hard to continue doing things that you don't personally love. I think that is probably. So I know that there's a lot of skills that are transferable. So like systems thinking, for example, I was just talking with a person at work about this recently, and that applies to a ton of industries, and you can really apply it anywhere. And then there are some like non-transferable skills that you might learn in management classes. What do you think has been the most useful skill from your graduate work in management and kind of organization that you apply to agriculture? If you could talk to another farmer that's trying to update and bring his farm into the 20 or her farm into the 21st century, what do you think are the most useful, one or two useful concepts that you took away that you apply regularly?
I think so, just learning, I was very like drawn to strategy, so like strategic management and just strategic thinking. And I think for me, that has like overall, because no matter like what I've done, whether it's with my products or helping like our fresh produce business grow, I feel like that skill of just like strategic thinking, strategic management, and just creating a strategy that's more of like a long-term thing has really helped me navigate like some of the challenges that we faced, or just innovating, or just juggling all the different roles and things and responsibilities that come with being a business owner and a farmer. And then I teach full time also. So it's just, that's, I think, been probably the best skill that I've learned, along with marketing and just that side of things. But I would say that more so I feel like I've learned as I've gone. I learned about marketing in school, but not to the level that I have through just my professional career. Yeah, I would definitely say learn about strategy, because that is going to help you make the right decisions and just weed through some of the stuff.
Let's say you were hired as a consultant to go into a medium-sized farm that's struggling and looking for a way to reinvent itself. What kind of conversation would you have? What kinds of things would you talk with them about as they're trying to bring themselves, like we said, into the 21st century and update their systems, update their products, update their approach? Like, how would you advise them?
Yeah. So one of the things I would probably say is look at what like the core competencies are. Like for us, like I said, it's like quality is a huge thing. It's why like our customers come back week after week at the farmers market. It's the story. So even I think humanizing the business, like that's important, whether you're giant, like whether you're Pepsi or whether you're somebody like us. I think that resonates with people nowadays, especially like the younger generation, where they value transparency a lot more. And so I think that What are the core competencies? Like, where does a farm see itself in the future? What direction do they want to go in? And then what's their capacity to market themselves? And then also probably, I would say maybe looking at other channels to generate revenue from. That's something that we, and especially with COVID, that kind of helped us fuel like looking into those other channels of distribution and other revenue streams because we were forced to, but it really benefited us now, 4 years later. It's been really beneficial. So I would say really standing firm on what it is that your farm represents, and then having a clear vision, direction, looking for opportunities, and then looking at, okay, what are the resources we need to get to where it is that we want to go, whether that's grant funding, whether that's loans, whatever the case may be. So I think, again, that goes back to what's your strategy?
I ask everyone this question. I like to ask people to think about how their profession affects the way they see a place. And so when I look at the Central Valley or Fresno or Reedley or wherever, my background is education. So I tend to look at the world through that lens, seeing both the problems and solutions from that vantage point. For you, how does what you do affect the way you see the Central Valley?
Oh, I think I have a very, because I also teach, so I'm very much connected to the people, the community, next generation even. And then on the farming side, again, it's like we're connected to our customers, but then also like the land and the community. And so for me, I just view the Central Valley as like a very unique and special place, because, and this has changed over the years, because at one point, like I said, I was like, there's not enough here. And I think a lot of people can view it that way. There's just not enough here. But for me, I feel like it's unique and special because we are, and we're very, it's a very family community, tight-knit community that's really based in these more, I would say, traditional type of values, because it is an agricultural community. And I think that there's something special about that, that if you go to LA or any other bigger cities, they just don't have that. It's just like it's a bigger city, but it just has that very, you just feel a lot more connected to the people, and I would say not only connected, but I feel like I feel more invested in the community and the people, and just ensuring that it sustains itself, and that we keep it what it, just keep it the special place. Because like I said, I've lived different places throughout my life, and I came back here, and this place is just, I'm proud to call this my home. And is it perfect? No, but obviously there's change can be had, but I think that there is something that is unique, and maybe I'm not exactly sure what that exact thing is, but it's just something that makes this area very, very different than other places, and it's just drawn me back in. So, yeah.
We always close these podcasts in the same place. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
So, business book wise, I would say Blue Ocean Strategy, that book. I actually read that in graduate school, and it has stayed one of my favorite business books. And it's pretty short, but it goes back to strategic thinking and just looking at everything very differently. And it completely changed my perspective on business and on coming up with new products and innovating and looking at different industries. So I think that is a must read business book. And then the other one I would say is, let me, I need to get the exact title.
Yep.
So give me one second. Oh, here it is. Okay, so my friend actually recommended this book, and it was just an amazing perspective, but it's called David and Goliath: Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, and that's by Malcolm Gladwell. So that is another really good book that has a different perspective. I like reading things that just have either it's going to change my perspective or yeah, I like things like that kind of change my way of thinking. So that's another good book.
To close, where can people find out more about Blaking Farms and where can people buy your products if they would like to purchase them?
Yeah, if you want to learn more about Blaking Farms, you can follow our Instagram. I think that's where we don't post like constantly, but definitely if there's any updates, anything new going on, that's where you'll get all the latest information. And our website is blakenfarms.com, and that's so in the off season, which is now when we don't have fresh produce, we have our value added products. And so those can be purchased through our website. And we're just starting to look into getting into retailers for this season. And so I won't have that list, but I usually will post who we're going to sell to on Instagram. So,
Fantastic.
yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, Amber.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.